common fact.
Your Honor, may it please the Court. This case presents a good example of the hallmarks that distinguish legitimate versus illegitimate class actions and class settlements. And these cases present five red flags for why these settlements cross the line.
Now, and you're representing whom?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I represent the Speedway objectors,
right.
Retailer objectors.
Your name is?
And my name is Tristan Duncan. And the five red flags that demonstrate that these class settlements...
Do you have standing?
Yes, Honor, Your Honor, we do.
Why don't you address standing first? Because you're not parties to these proceedings, are you?
Well, Your Honor, we were defendants below, but we've
right.
been dismissed with prejudice. We won at the jury with the jury trial, and we won on summary judgment. But we have standing for two different reasons. The first standing is... that we have, I represent clients who are class members, and they're class members because they have purchased fuel from some of these defendants. And so they are members of the class. There is no dispute that the declarations that we provided showing proof of purchase demonstrates class membership. And so once we have class membership, we can immediately go to challenging the merits of the class settlements. But even if we didn't have that, we also have plain legal prejudice. Therefore, we do have class membership. Can
you
I move
have,
on to the merits?
No, you can't.
Okay.
Thanks, but I have a question. The district court found you have a bigger problem than standing. She included it in her standing section, but she said the Speedway objectors did not file their objections within the timeline. They filed an objection. Let me ask a question. They file an objection on the date they were due from another party. And then on May 6, 2015, this is all recited in the district court's order, the objectors substituted that objection with one based on class membership by two entirely different parties. And the district court said that was not a timely objection. She did not give you permission to substitute. And so you essentially waived or forfeited that objection.
Yeah. Okay,
so please respond to that.
Yes. There is a distinction between filing the objections, which were timely filed. We timely filed the objections.
No. The two parties who you now are suggesting are class members did not timely file an objection.
Yes, they did, Your Honor. They filed a timely objection. The only thing that didn't get filed was proof of purchase. And you
okay,
could always,
what is it? Am I, what district court, what, let me recite from the district court order if I'm, what am I missing here?
She is making an improper distinction between timely filing an objection and proof of purchase in the from the defendant.
Did you object to her findings?
Yes, Your Honor.
On that basis?
Yes, we argued at our hearing that we timely filed.
After she issued this order saying you didn't timely file an objection?
Well, we certainly made it clear in our briefing before the court and in our oral argument before her that the objections were all timely filed. The only issue was proof of claim, proof of purchase from the defendants. And you can always prove standing after you've made your allegations.
This isn't about standing. I'm not talking about standing.
I'm
talking about... You substituted Speedway and Murphy Oil on May 6, 2015, which was after the March 23, 2015 deadline, or you used the term substituted, for the Marathon client that you initially said was a member of the settlement class. That's what I'm talking about.
I understand.
And what am I not understanding?
Okay, the Speedway and Murphy objectors were a part of the timely filed objection. They simply filed proof of claim, proof of membership, the receipts showing they actually bought fuel from these particular settling defendants to prove they had standing in as a class member. So they timely filed their objection.
Well,
the only thing that gets
certainly, I guess the problem I'm seeing is that is not at all what the district court said. And she was pretty definitive, and I'm surprised.
And that's why we appealed it. That's what we've appealed.
But
she's wrong. That's a legal error.
There's no argument about that at all in your brief.
Yes, there is. We addressed
about this legal error. No, yes. This isn't standing. This is waiver forfeiture.
Right.
I need you to distinguish.
Right. And in our brief, we talk about the distinction between timely filed objections, and we say we timely filed our objections and proof of claim.
And
we specifically have a section on that.
And you discussed the district court's apparent misstatement about Marathon and Speedway and Murphy Oil and the...
Yes. We say that it's a clear legal error.
Okay. I apologize. I must have missed that.
Well, how are you? How did you suffer plain legal prejudice?
Your Honor, I see my time is.
Somebody else going to argue that?
Somebody else is arguing for some of the other objectors.
So somebody answers my question. I don't care who answers it, as long as it's answered.
Well, he doesn't have a plain legal prejudice.
Then why don't you?
Are your five red flags in the brief?
Excuse me?
You mentioned five red flags that you were going to talk about, and then you never got to.
Right.
Are those in the brief?
They are, but they aren't denominated specifically as five red flags.
Right.
I'll recite them real quick.
I'll leave it to you whether you want to summarize them quickly or yield your time.
Okay. I'll just tell them real quickly. The first is that we're dealing with prospective injunctive relief. Second red flag, the nature of the prospective injunctive relief is itself political in nature. The benefit to the class depends upon regulators and legislatures passing new regulations before the benefit is even possible. That is the hallmark of the lack of redressability, and therefore these actions are even non-justiciable. Third, we're dealing with the benefit of the class.
This is a settlement. This is a settlement of the class action.
Right.
You have to distinguish that from the initial claim.
But
the parties agreed to resolve it.
Right, but the nature of the...
Disability isn't really the issue at this point.
The nature of the settlement, what is the benefit? The benefit is defined as lobbying regulators to change the law. That is not relief that an Article III court can grant. That's why this prospective injunctive relief is not involving conduct of the defendants. It involves the plaintiff's counsel going and lobbying the regulators to change the law. And once the law is changed, then the court finds that will be a benefit. That is completely beyond an Article III court's power to grant. The third is that we're talking about bargaining away constitutional rights here. The fourth is the Cypre Fund escheats to the state for any purpose at all. Fifth, the claims at issue here are not even colorable claims. The current right that exists is the right to buy volumetric fuel, not temperature-compensated fuel. And so these actions aren't even justiciable. And I'll yield my time to it.
Thank you, Your Honors. Theodore H. Frank for the Alcon objectors. In Pearson versus NBTY, a Judge Posner opinion from the Seventh Circuit, 772 F3rd 778, the court held that Rule 23E was violated when the parties structured a settlement so that the lawyers would get over $2 million and the class would get $900,000. It was called a selfish settlement and untenable under Rule 23E. This settlement's much worse. It's $19 million for the attorneys, zero for the class. And it's not even the case that the class is getting nothing. They're getting worse than nothing. They're being made worse off because they're going to lobby. The settlement provides for a $12 million slush fund to lobby for laws that make the class worse off.
In that Pearson case, I think the court used a one-third amount. And I wondered about that. It found there was an abuse of discretion and said that normally the attorney fees shouldn't exceed one-third of the total settlement amount. Are you familiar with that part of the portion?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I wondered, is that in case law, is that generally stated?
The proposition is that the attorneys shouldn't make themselves the primary beneficiaries in terms of settlement fairness, not just adequacy, but fairness. The allocation is important, and Pampers made this point too at 724 F3rd 713, that while the parties are negotiating at arm's length in terms of the size of the settlement, the attorneys have every incentive to structure the settlement so that they get the benefits for themselves. And here you had parties willing to put $30 million on the table, and they announced to the court, we have no way of distributing this to the class. We're going to do this injunctive relief instead while waiving everybody's D3 claims.
Do you think there is a way they could have distributed that to the class?
I think so, because it's been done. In Fraley versus Facebook, a Northern District of California case, there are 100 million class members because everybody has Facebook. $20 million settlement fund, of which about $15 million would go to the class. And the court not only didn't have trouble distributing it, it ended up having money left over for CyPrep.
How does it distribute it? Just put some sort of a voucher on the internet or something?
Class members can make claims for $10 checks. And as with all of these consumer settlements, less than 1% of the class made a claim, and they distributed $8 million or so, and $7 million went to CyPrep, which we find problematic.
Did the court hold a hearing here as to the reasonableness of the attorney fees?
No, because
time determination is the amount of time the lawyers put in exchange as a factor of the amount of the compensation.
It's beyond that. It's a Rule 23 issue, not just a Rule 23H issue.
Okay.
Because the attorneys were compromising the party's claims, and in fact, completely waiving them without any compensation at all, and then structuring the settlement to take the lion's share of the value of the settlement for themselves. It's an allocational issue. And as I don't think we said it in our preach, but as the Ninth Circuit said in HP Inkjet, you don't get paid for putting in hours in a class action. You get paid for achieving results. And you can't just say, well, we had a lot of lodestar, so it's okay that we're getting less than our lodestar and the class isn't getting anything. Baby Products rejected that, 708 F3rd 163. And similarly, the Seventh Circuit repeatedly in the Posner trilogy said that the issue again is the attorneys structuring the settlement so they get the majority of the benefit for themselves.
When you said you don't get paid for hours, you get paid for results, I understand that. But here, they did get results. They just weren't monetary.
Certainly.
Is there any case law you can point to that says when you get results, you get some benefit, and the court did discuss that.
Well,
district court, that's not enough. It's never enough.
If there are actual results, that would be something. And as we argue in our brief, the idea that there are results is clearly erroneous, because the results are we're going to lobby for a law or get vendors to implement a program that will make consumers worse off. The results are this ATC thing, but the benefits of it, the judge relied upon the California Energy Commission, but the California Energy Commission said, we're not going to do this. It's going to make consumers worse off.
That's the third time you've said that, consumers worse off. So tell me what you mean.
I mean exactly what the California Energy Commission found at page 7801 in the appendix, that the costs of this exceed the benefits. And we're talking extraordinarily minuscule benefits.
Do you mean the consumers will pay more at the pump and receive the same product? Put it in concrete terms for me.
It will raise the price of gasoline to consumers with infinitesimal informational benefits that the California Energy Commission found to be about 1 cent per consumer per year. That's what we're fighting over here. We're fighting over the scenario where on the rare occasion where you're looking at two gas stations across the street from one another and one of them is 1 cent cheaper than the other, but their fuel happens to be warmer and it happens to have the same energy content. It doesn't have a different formulation and it doesn't have ethanol and one doesn't. That slight difference in temperature might cause somebody to buy gasoline when they would have preferred to buy it across the street. And that adds up to 1 cent per consumer.
Wasn't it more
per year.
About the informational aspects? Right now, consumers don't know anything about what that variation in temperature might be, that they might be getting less energy because of higher temperatures. And yet the retailers are purchasing that at a discounted price based on the temperature. And so my understanding of what the district judge was trying to do was at least get an informational benefit out there to consumers. That's the benefit that we have.
Your premise is contradicted by the record. And again, the California Energy Commission at 7870 to 71 found that prices adjust in response to the temperature variations and that retailers aren't ripping off consumers or getting any additional benefit.
I didn't use the term ripping off. I don't know that I would have used that term.
Certainly, but they're not getting any swellage are getting passed along to the consumer. But in terms of the informational benefit, it's not clear, it's false that it actually increases informational benefit because it gives the illusion of informational benefit because you still have different BTUs even if gas is at the same temperature because the formulation might be different and the variation there is about 5% from gallon to gallon across the street. There's no disclosure of what the effect of ethanol is, and that's about the same as a 60-degree temperature difference.
Can I also ask, I'm a little concerned on what you're asking us to assume as far as the attorney fees, since we don't have a determination yet, and yet I understand that you're making this about the class, and you're not necessarily at this point, you're not challenging that attorney fee.
Well,
are we to assume at this point that since it was approved for up to $24.7 million, that it's going to be $24.7
million? The court approved
perhaps it'll be
million.
$2 million.
The court approved $19
million. When did that happen?
A few months ago.
Is that in the record?
I think plaintiff's counsel filed the 28J.
Okay. And it was $19 million. So we can now
18.9 to be precise. But
all right.
In measuring whether there's any value, one thing that I don't understand is gas is stored underground at the service station. And I assume that that's fairly uniform and that there's some regulation on it. Why would the temperature of the gas vary from station to station? I can't believe they're heating the gasoline.
That's exactly what Consumer Reports says. Don't even bother considering it because it's underground, it's well insulated. So there might be that first couple of hours when it's downloaded from the tank that it might be different, but again, you're not talking, this is why it's fixing it,
well,
quote unquote.
Is there anything in the record that will tell us what we are talking about?
Yes.
Remember the old maxim, de minimis non curat lex? What are we talking about here?
It's all in the California Energy Commission report that the district court relied upon.
That's in the record?
Yes, the appendix in the 7800 range is the first thing.
Don't let me characterize this for you, but is this what you're saying essentially, that what we have is a massive nuisance value settlement that the attorneys are really doing well on and the consumers are at best neutral?
I don't want to say that, except I exactly agree with that. I'm running into my rebuttal time.
Okay. Well, why don't you want to say it is what I would ask. Use the rest of the rebuttal? Okay.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, my name is Daniel Doris, and I'm here
If you'll pull up the microphone, please.
Sure.
And thank you, Mr. Doris.
I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff class. I'd like to start by setting the context in which this appeal arises. There are 29 settlements. Only 10 of those settlements are before this court. No one has standing to challenge the remaining 19 settlements. Neither the Frank objectors nor the Speedway objectors claim to be members of the class for 19 settlements. And those settlements will go through because there's no one with standing to challenge them. Now, the 10 remaining settlements that the Frank objectors claim to be class members of,
so what you're saying is this is a gotcha situation where even if we grant this relief, a whole bunch of other folks are going to be stuck and then Costco's going to come in and say, well, this is exactly where we should be out because some are in, some are out, and their value is absolutely de minimis.
Your Honor, all I'm saying here is that there are 19 settlements that are not before this court and that no relief could be granted with respect to those 19 settlements. There's no one withstanding to challenge them here. Now, the 10 remaining...
Does that include additional attorney fees to the attorney fees present before us, or are those all covered by the attorney fees?
Those were addressed, and counsel briefly mentioned this, but I don't think he mentioned the entire history of what happened with the attorney's fee order. Several months ago, the district court finally granted attorney's fees for all 29 settlements. The time for appeal has ran. The Frank objectors did not appeal that fee ruling. It's not before this court. Apparently, they saw no reason to challenge the fees that were awarded in this case.
Has a court ever approved something like this where you have two bellwether cases that go down in flames and you have at least a vigorous debate on whether the consumers get anything if they come out even neutral or whether they're prejudiced? Large amount of attorney's fees, and the relief is not to give the class members some sort of compensation, but instead to create this fund to go lobby legislators and try and get this put in. That just seems way out there on the spectrum to me. And if I'm wrong about that, tell me other cases like this.
Your Honor, I believe the premise of the question, some of that is incorrect, and that's why the settlement may appear troublesome. It's not, but let me say the premise is wrong. Their premise is that there's no benefit to this settlement. There is. When consumers go to gas stations right now, they don't know what the temperature is, and the temperature...
Well, wait a minute. I mean, since the study of physics began, it has been a well-known proposition that because of the kinetic energy of the molecules of the liquid, on a per-liter basis, there's going to be an expansion and a contraction depending on the temperature in an inverse order. The colder the temperature, the more the contraction. The hotter the temperature, the more the expansion. I mean, that is like, duh, 101A physics. That's maybe even sixth grade science. Now, what is the consumer achieving here by the settlements that have been placed before us?
The consumers receive two benefits. First, Your Honor, is the evidence shows the consumers don't know that they are receiving
different... Well, it's too bad. They should have gone to their sixth grade science class, because if they had, they'd know that. So the only question is what's... Are you going to say that there's going to be a thermometer on the pump that says the storage temperature of this gasoline is X?
Your Honor, what will happen is there will be ATC pumps that will ensure consumers get the same amount of energy content for their dollar so they can accurately compare prices from one pump to the next pump. That doesn't occur.
And what is the variation within the temperature ranges that we're talking about here in percentage terms?
Yes, I believe you had a question earlier about why is the temperature different. And the evidence in the record is that some of the tanks are different. There can be double-walled tanks, single-walled tanks. And if you go to Appendix 7505 to 7506, the district court discusses evidence where even at
what
the
is
same...
The range? What is the range?
The district court cites evidence of 8-degree differences between pumps at the same station.
And 10 degrees in temperature results in one degree of change in the value of the energy.
I believe
right?
A little less than 1%, Your Honor.
So we're talking, that's what's at stake here.
Yes, Your Honor, this is the type of suit that class actions are meant to address. Well, there are small per transaction things that add up to a large amount for a lot of consumers. And these cases address that problem head on by facilitating the use of ATC pumps so that consumers
wouldn't
can
it be
compare.
Better to facilitate the use of double chamber storage tanks?
Your Honor,
it seemed to me that if you're concerned that the consumers are getting cheated, then you'd want to make sure that somehow the storage vessels are all having environmental technologies implemented into their construction so that the gas stays cool.
Your Honor, there are a variety of reasons why the gas can be different temperatures. The truck that comes in on can be different temperatures going into the tank. So there are many reasons why the temperature...
Okay, I want to talk about the informational benefit, which seems to be the only thing you can point to that the consumers are getting versus what the attorneys are getting. And what I think you're saying to me now is that informational benefit is highly speculative because it relies on the concept that there's going to be nationwide pumps, ATC pumps, which is entirely speculative.
No, Your Honor.
I mean, give me the immediate informational benefit that that consumers are going to have, the class members will have.
Five defendants have agreed to install ATC pumps. Five settlements are conversion settlements where the defendant has agreed to
install. And what's the coverage of those five?
Some of them are focused in California. Some of them are in other states. There are in the motion for final approval, I don't have the numbers before me, but there are a couple thousand pumps that will be switched by those gas stations.
A couple thousand out of how many pumps nationwide?
Your Honor, I don't have...
I'm just trying to figure out what is the real immediate benefit.
The immediate...
Informational benefit.
The immediate benefit is those five defendants will install ATC pumps. The other 24 settlements, they have set aside funds to facilitate the transfer to ATC pumps.
And you can't tell me how many of the class members will benefit from those particular settlements where there actually will be pumps installed?
Your Honor, they will have a choice. There will certainly be gas stations. There are a lot of non-selling devices.
That's not what I'm asking. How many people might benefit? Do you have any estimate?
From that portion
of the settlement?
These settlements will facilitate the installation of ATC pumps in the states in this litigation. That is 26 states with, I believe, over 100 million potential class members. All of those people will benefit.
I'm still having trouble putting this in my head. Let's say that all of this goes through and some of the defendants who settled, some did, some didn't, some are dismissed. If I go to Circle K, that's one thing, 7-Eleven, another, Costco. I go to one with one of these ATC pumps, and what do I see? I get out, I get the nozzle, and does it have some register, the temperature? Is there a conversion for what other gas stations are selling? I don't understand how I would even benefit a bit by this. And maybe I do, so can you explain how I do? How it works in the real world?
How it works in the real world, the gas stations that install the ATC, I don't believe, there's none that have it right now, but I imagine they would tell you there are ATC pumps. You can be assured that you are getting the same energy content for your dollar and that temperature variations are corrected for.
So does it just say what the temperature is of the gas that's going into the tank?
No, it will actually change the price.
Energy content per dollar is just a fancy way of telling us that that you're getting cooler gas or warmer gas, right?
Your Honor, what happens is if you buy gas at a higher temperature,
right,
the gas has swelled, so you receive less energy content.
That's right.
These pumps will correct for that, so you get the amount of energy content that you were expecting.
You mean it's going to give you more gas than
You could either adjust the amount of gas you're receiving or you could adjust the price. Either one would work to account for the temperature variation.
So you don't know how much you're paying for the gasoline until you put the nozzle in the pump and pull the trigger?
No, Your Honor. It'll give a price per gallon and then it will adjust the...
But the price per gallon is based on an estimate of what the temperature is going to be. You don't know that until it goes through the nozzle, do you?
Your Honor, what this will allow consumers to do is to know and compare two prices. What they can't do right now is look at prices at one pump and prices at another gas station and accurately compare those prices due to temperature variations. This will allow them to see the price at those two pumps and those two gas stations and know that those prices can be compared and account for temperature variations.
But your opposing counsel says there's really not going to be any price cost savings. They came up with a penny a person over the course of a year. That's not something consumers really care about.
Your Honor,
don't really care about anything but the price.
I want to step back and talk about the benefit. You mentioned earlier there was only one benefit, and that was the price transparency. Well, stepping back, the benefit here, the entire oil industry buys gas on a temperature-corrected basis, except at the retail pump. There is a reason why they do that, and that's because it's the fairest and most accurate way to transact in gas. They don't do it at the retail pump. This fixes that. There are two benefits to that. One is the price transparency we've been discussing. And second is
If you're buying massive quantities of gas, maybe it makes a difference.
Well,
but for the typical consumer, it apparently doesn't.
When you aggregate all of the purchases, 100 million purchases at the retail level, it does make a difference. And you're
for
on
whom? It makes a for, difference for, in the abstract. But to any given, I think what Judge Moritz is saying is to any given consumer, is that correct, the statement that it's a penny per year?
No, Your Honor. First of all, that's one piece of evidence. I think it's important to realize that District Court here had 8 years of experience in an MDL that was thoroughly litigated. There were two class.
What findings are there about what it is going to say to the average consumer over the course of a year?
The district court looked at a lot of evidence, and it explained what evidence it found persuasive and didn't find persuasive. There was the SAFER report before it. It pegged the benefits at over $100 million just for the Costco settlement alone.
You're not answering my question. Sure. Is there any evidence per consumer what the savings might be over any period of time?
No, the district court did not make a specific factual finding on what a per consumer benefit would be. Your Honor, but it wasn't required to. The case law is clear on this. We cite those cases in our brief. A district court in approving settlements like this does not need to make a specific factual finding about what the exact monetary benefits were.
I understand that, but when there's nothing, when there's no monetary benefit, or no evidence of any monetary benefit to any individual member of the class. Isn't that significant, and isn't that something that the district court and we should be concerned about?
No, Your Honor. The benefit is the informational benefit plus the other benefit.
But $18 million going to the attorneys?
Your Honor.
Can you point me to any case that has facts, anything like this, where there's no evidence of any monetary benefit for any individual, but the attorneys are getting $18
million? Your Honor, yes, we cite a lot of cases in our.
I didn't see any like this.
Well, name your best one and how it compares on the facts to this one.
There is the Third Circuit case about the LexisNexis changing their business practices because it allegedly harmed people's privacy interests. There is the First Circuit case.
I don't see how that's even remotely the same. But let me just point this out. You said earlier this is why we have class actions, even though it's a de minimis amount. And I would totally get it if you had evidence that retailers were out there playing with this and making sure that consumers got less than they thought they were getting and something diabolical is going on. But you're just talking about gas in a tank and whether it has two shells or one shell.
No, Your Honor, that is the situation we have. We have a situation where at every step of the oil industry, they use ATC correction, except for the retail level. In Canada, they use it. Where the temperatures are cooler, they use it. Where it's hotter, they don't.
Why did you lose your bellwether cases then?
There was a jury trial. Both sides presented their evidence, and the jury found against the plaintiffs. That was a risk of the litigation, and that's why the settlement was a compromise. I mean, there are risks to the plaintiff's class. There's legitimacy to their claims, and it was a compromise. They recognized
the risk to the plaintiff class are that, well, I guess the risk to the defendants is they're going to spend a whole bunch of money defending this. That's the biggest risk I see to the defendants.
Well, I think what you're telling us, in any event, looking at the situation globally, is that apparently nobody appealed these settlements globally. That is to say, where they could be reached on a universal affirmance or reversal basis. And all we've got now are these little piecemeal appeals.
That's correct, Your Honor. You have 10 settlements before you, 19 settlements, no one has standing. And further, there's
not only not standing, but apparently haven't been appealed.
They are part of the appeal, but no one has standing. And briefly, you questioned about the evidentiary ruling, and I would just stress that is an evidentiary ruling reviewed for abuse of discretion. There's no reason to find the district.
So if we find that Speedway does have standing, is that a way of getting at this, at the situation globally? Is that what you're telling me?
If you agreed with the Speedway objector's argument on legal prejudice, you could find that they have standing for the 29 settlements. That would be an incorrect step because
but that could reach only 29 settlements.
That would reach all 29 settlements. The court should not do that.
All 29.
The court should not do that because, not, as the court mentioned, they aren't members of these settlements. These settlements don't affect their legal rights in any way whatsoever. They can do business tomorrow.
Well, I asked a question about how they were prejudiced. Nobody ever answered my question because everybody was pointing at themselves. So I still don't know how. I'm not going to ask you the question because I guess you're going to tell me they're not prejudiced.
Right, Your Honor. There's no prejudice.
Do you concede they timely objected? Is the district court wrong about that?
What they didn't timely do, the class notice required them to state which settlements they objected to and why.
And why.
And they didn't say that. That requirement required them to state how they were harmed by the settlement.
And when did they do that eventually?
Well, I think they have a minute and 29 seconds of rebuttal time.
Yeah.
Judge
Morrison,
maybe he'll answer that question.
I was just trying to see if he conceded that issue because I thought I understood that it hadn't been conceded by your briefs.
No, we don't concede that they have standing at all, Your Honor, and they don't have legal privilege.
And I'm not talking about standing. I was talking about waiver.
All right, we don't concede
which
that.
The district court made a separate finding about.
Your Honor, I want to address another point that they've mentioned in their arguments, and that is that these settlements require lobbying or a change in the law. And the district court looked at all the facts and found that to be untrue. That's at Appendix 7515 to 7517. It goes through the evidence that shows if these settlements are approved, that states allow ATC right now. The only step that is necessary is the ministerial step of providing regulatory approval for the devices that dispense fuel. That's like an underwriter's laboratory certification of a device. It's not a requirement to change the law. No regulations need to be changed. there's going to be no lobbying here to change the law or regulations. That's just untrue. The district court went through that evidence. And I would just highlight the letter from the California regulators in 2011. They wrote to the plaintiff's class saying their law right now allows ATC. There's a device that's already been approved. New Mexico, they had a deposition of their state weights and measures official. He said, we allow ATC. 50-state survey, 36 states say, we allow ATC. The evidence is overwhelming that there's no change in law necessary. And, Your Honor, that goes to the benefit of the settlement. It's not speculative that it'll be implemented. It will. The district court looked at the evidence and found and weighed the evidence and the benefits and found that it would be implemented. On the First Amendment, I believe that's covered by our briefs. If the court has any further questions.
Is there anything in the record that will tell us what's in it for the retailer and whether they have any way of jigging the system to in a way that they can end up delivering less gas collectively to consumers by selling gas on warmer days or something?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is the safer
the record.
The safer declaration.
Like
safer
how much would Speedway make per year by virtue of not having ATC pumps?
Your Honor, yes, there is evidence that the most prominent one is the safer affidavit. The district court had 8 years of litigation of hearing exactly how defendants.
Well, what are the facts? Tell us.
The facts. The safer affidavit looked at the Costco settlement, found the benefits to be over $100 million for that settlement alone. And, Your Honor, reviewing that evidence is a factual determination. The district court, it went through a trial. It had two summary judgment rulings, two class certification rulings. It looked at all this evidence, and it made a factual finding that these settlements benefited the class. That factual finding is reviewed for clear error, and I don't see any clear error here. The district court had evidence before it, and it credited some and rejected others. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Good, I'm glad it's you that came up. Yes. How are you prejudiced?
All right, so first, I am showing you right here, this is the objection that was timely filed,
okay,
right on
that,
the cover.
Thank you. Would you answer my question and then answer Judge Moritz's question, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
We are prejudiced in two ways. Business interests are prejudiced and our First Amendment interests are prejudiced. Our business interests are prejudiced because this is the regulatory environment in which we do business. And we currently have a substantive right to sell fuel in a non-temperature compensated way.
So in other words, you have the right to, I don't want to use the word either, cheat consumers or to trick consumers by selling on warm days. It's not trick or anything. It's just, as I said, it's just elementary physics. On warm days, you're going to deliver less gas, but charge the same amount to the consumers. That doesn't seem to me like you're being prejudiced.
We're being prejudiced because we have a right to sell fuel in a non-temperature compensated way, and the decision makers that Congress has selected to decide what is the most fair and non-deceptive method of sale is a non-temperature compensated method of sale. We just heard a policy argument. This policy argument has been presented to the weights and measures regulators who have rejected the notion that temperature compensation is the most fair and non-deceptive method of sale. And the reason is because what Judge Moritz was coming up with, and that is that it doesn't in fact give an informational benefit because you don't buy uniform energy content. If you bought temperature compensated fuel thinking that you were getting uniform energy content, you would be wrong. There are multiple reasons that energy content fluctuates, and so the regulators specifically concluded that ATC is more confusing and misleading and creates unfair competition. So if ATC gets approved,
you have 43 seconds. Why don't you answer Judge Moore?
Okay, this is the timely filed objection right on the cover. Murphy,
what's the date of that?
It's March
Murphy,
March 23rd, 2015. The date,
and that's Murphy.
Yes, Murphy Oil and Speedway, right listed on the cover.
Okay.
And
so the district court was just off on.
It's an erroneous conclusion. It's
okay.
Just a flat out erroneous conclusion. We are class members, and it details everything that the class notice.
So when you substituted there was a term substitute used a couple weeks later in May when you filed, a couple months later when you filed an objection, the more detailed objection.
The only thing that was substituted was simply the affidavit showing proof of purchase in the class.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Go ahead. Well, I think she did require you the day by March 23rd of whatever year it was to file your proof of membership in the class. And that's what she said wasn't filed by March 23rd.
There was no requirement to file proof of purchase. No, she made that up.
I didn't say proof of purchase. I said of membership in the class.
There was no requirement to file proof of membership in the class.
That's what the order stated.
Right, that's wrong. The only thing that we had to do was comply with the class notice. The class notice said nothing about filing proof of membership.
I'll look at that further, and I appreciate your pointing me to the right information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shall we proceed with the Costco case? All right, we'll proceed to the